The older I get, the more I realize that my driving purpose in life is to help people realize that God has a plan and a purpose for them and to help them discover what that is.
Everybody, Doc Brian here, and welcome to Doc Talks. We talk about people's troubles, trials, tribulations, and hopefully triumphs in life. Today, we're in LifeWord Studios, Conway, Arkansas, broadcasting in over 150 languages to 127 countries to a potential listening audience of 2 billion people. Today, I have with me a good friend, Nathan King. Nathan, it's good to have you with us here today.
Great to be here today, Brian.
So we were just talking, you know, yeah. we came from the same background as AG kids back in the day. So we know a lot of the same people. We just didn't realize we knew a lot of the same people.
Wild.
So you are a pastor here. Well, you're the internet pastor, according to TikTok. But you're here with New Life Church.
That's right.
So tell us a little bit about what you do with New Life.
Yeah, so my primary responsibility is I oversee our school of ministry across the state of Arkansas. Mm-hmm. And our job is to, it's a training institute, not higher education necessarily. So our job is to train and develop leaders for our campuses all across the state through several different avenues.
Yeah. So how many campuses does New Life currently have?
We have 18.
Okay.
Yeah. Wow.
So just all over the place.
All over the place.
Yeah. So, and I do see from time to time you travel to different campuses and preach.
I do, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's one of my favorite things I get to do with my job.
Yeah. Well, I was about to ask, what is the honey part of your job that you enjoy the most?
Yeah. I don't think this may be an overgeneralization, mm-hmm. but I don't think most pastors who love being a pastor, and I love getting to be a pastor, I think that most of them would probably answer people, right? Because that's, you want to help people. And anything that I can do that helps people, that's it for me. Yeah. And the older I get, the more I realize that my driving purpose in life is to help people realize that God has a plan and a purpose for them, mm-hmm. and help them discover what that is. Yeah. If I get to do that in a classroom, or if I get to do that from a pulpit or online or whatever avenue that takes, mm-hmm. or in a book, however, like that's really what lights me up, is just helping people.
Yeah. You know, we talk about that transformation that we see at salvation in a person. Mm-hmm. But there is also that exciting experience where we see them find out who they are in Christ by their calling as well. That there's just something about that that makes all things new as well.
For sure.
So tell us a little bit about how you became into ministry, where you felt your calling take place about that time.
Yeah, it happened early for me. I gave my life to the Lord when I was 11 years old. In fact, it was the week before my birthday. Grew up in a tiny little town, and there was like, we called them crusades back in the day, mm-hmm. you know, the big like citywide events. And every year my hometown would have this thing called the Joy Fest. And one night they had this guy or this band singing, and this guy presents the gospel. And I grew up in a great church, going to church. I'd heard it all these different times, but I just never put my faith in Jesus consciously. Mm-hmm. Even though I was a church kid, I was trying to do the right things and all that. But that night I did, and I gave my life to the Lord. And I had my Aunt Joanne, my uncle ran a parts store. She didn't work there at all, but she was in there working every day, if you know what I mean, because that's that generation, right? And my dad was a school teacher. Every day after school, we'd go in, hang out at this parts store. I don't know why, but we were there, and my aunt started asking me every day, Nathan, honey, you've been reading your Bible, you know, and every day I would look at her and I would lie to her. I'm like, yeah, I've been reading my Bible. But I started feeling bad about it because I really had given my life to the Lord. So I started trying to read my Bible. Mm. 11 years old, and we grew up, you know, with a very specific translation that was expected to be read. And I'm a hillbilly. I tell everybody I'm an educated hillbilly. I realized real quick that the language that this Bible was translated in was never intended to be understood by little seventh grade hillbillies. So I went to my parents, said, hey, I need a Bible I can get that I can understand. They got me one, and that was 33 years ago. Mm-hmm. And really quickly after that, my faith was flourishing, and I just realized there was something about this that I was supposed to do with. And I didn't know what that meant. Like, when I grew up, you know, if you had a calling on your life, that meant you were either going to be a pastor of a church or you were supposed to go to Africa and be a missionary.
Right.
That were the only two options they ever talked about.
Right.
So over my teenage years that began to flourish. By the time I got to college, I moved into a college dorm and started seeing all these things that didn't compute with what I'd been raised to believe, and not because my church was bad, just because my head was full of a lot of man-made ideas that didn't necessarily come from Scripture. And I did something that freaked out everybody who loved me. I decided I was throwing out everything I believed, except for two things that I were completely convinced of. I was completely convinced that the Bible was the Word of God, and I was completely convinced that Jesus was the Son of God. So I threw out everything else. These days we call that deconstruction. There wasn't a fancy word for it back then, but people still did it. I did it. And I spent the next 2.5 years, just every night, I would get my Bible out, read it for myself, and let the Lord guide me to what I really believed. Of course, over time, that's matured and all those sorts of things. But in that season of figuring out, that 2.5 year season, I lived in a dorm, right, with my best friend. We had so much fun all the time, just being ridiculous, the things that we would do. You can imagine, college guys. Well, we were the fun people. So everybody wanted to hang out in our room all the time. We also had two TVs, with like a PlayStation and a Nintendo, so that probably helped. Yeah. But before we knew it, we were having these discussions at night. Like, I would read, he would read, we would both talk about it. He was my pastor's son when I was growing up, so very close in our faith and in our friendship. All these guys would cram into our college dorm room, and we were having these discussions about the Word of God and faith and all these kinds of things. And I didn't know it, but that's how ministry started for me. Right. Because before long, an organization came along and was like, hey, you're already doing this. Would you come do this for us? Mm-hmm. So, boom. That was 27 years ago.
Wow. So, did you go to Arkansas Tech?
I did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's kind of, it's like you either go to, what is it, Central in Springfield? The AGs? I'd say it's CBC, but not Central Baptist College in Conway.
Right. Yeah. I think that college is closed.
Is it?
Now. Yeah, well, it's Evangel now. Yeah. Or,
well, that was the thing. If you grew up AG, you either went to Arkansas Tech or you went up to Springfield to the Assembly of God College.
The one we always heard about, and I don't know if it was because we had staff that had went there or not, was Southwestern. In I think you pronounce it Wachahatchee, Texas. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. So as your faith began to grow, what did you really see come out of that as far as your influence with people around you within your faith?
Yeah, it was interesting because I was kind of an athlete in high school, not a good one, but I attempted to be an athlete. Interesting fact, though, is that I started school a year early, so I was always smaller and younger than everybody on all my teams. So I never, like, excelled in that. But I was on the team and, you know, had friends and all that kind of stuff. So it was the interesting stereotypical dynamic, you know, of, you know, I don't know if I was the only Christian, but I was maybe the only outspoken Christian in the locker room. And all the guys are not bad guys necessarily. They're just lost guys, right, doing what lost people do. And sometimes there was, you know, joking and that sort of thing. I was never, like, persecuted for my faith, and that kind of thing. People respected it. And, you know, I was like that guy. That's just the reputation I had. Got to college, and it was the same thing. Of course, when I got to college, there was a much larger body of people of faith that I could plug into. It was just critical for me when I was in that season of trying to figure things out, work things out. And from the moment that I got there, I started seeing all of these opportunities to connect with people and have conversations with people. And I've always been an outgoing guy for the most part, not afraid to have those kinds of discussions, probably to my detriment because I would assume a lot of things and make a lot of claims and that sort of thing. And I didn't have the chops to support some of those. So,
So working in this with people who feel like they have a calling in ministry.
Yeah.
Being that we're a mental health podcast,
yeah,
what do you see the most common mental health, and I don't want to say condition or diagnosis, but
sure,
maybe struggle within people who are coming into the ministry?
The most common. Well, I think if I look at just the history of maybe friends who have been, like, in the trenches with us and then left and things like that, I think burnout. burnout and exhaustion.
Yeah.
I think almost all of us who do what we do go through that in some capacity. Mm-hmm. And so we, you know, I've gone through it at different seasons at different levels, mm-hmm. Because I've been doing this a long time now. And I think you have to just be incredibly intentional and aware of that can happen.
Yeah.
So it's part of what we do, you know, in the institute that I run for our church is to equip people with tools to identify things like that to the best that we know how to help them avoid those kinds of things. Yeah. So,
yeah, I was just at a conference last week in Atlanta, and I took a bunch of – it was like New Life yeah. set up, had many different campuses. They came for like a staff retreat conference thing.
Cool.
And I did breakout sessions on mental health within the pastorate.
Yeah.
But then burnout as well. And it seems like that a lot of the burnout is happening because of unresolved mental health issues that are on that back burner. As you know, we've talked about, you know, we just got a new church, and the church prior to absolved and a lot of their people came and joined us, but I was interviewed, you know, by some of these people.
Yeah.
What does your week look like? You know, what is, and, you know, I said, well, I try to take Fridays off and,
yeah.
you know, have that time for me, Friday and Saturdays. And then you know, a couple of weeks ago, I was at the church on Friday doing something. One of them came by and said, well, isn't today your day off? And really, you don't get a day off. You know, you still have to answer the phone and do whatever happens. And I think that the people in ministry get caught in that trap of not so much that they're expected to do it, but they expect themselves to get it done. Mm-hmm. And that's so unhealthy mm-hmm. for not just for the church, but for the minister themselves to have that high standard. And, you know, we talk about having high standard, but there are limitations to that standard. Yeah. So, you know, in ministry and specifically, you know, in mental health, we see, you know, even family issues or loss will pour over into ministry. And if we're not healthy, then we can't be healthy in any aspect of our life.
Right.
So has there ever been an occasion where specifically you remember something about one person where that poured over into their life that led to a detriment of ministry?
I mean, even in my own life, I've experienced it. Mm-hmm. You know, I think all of us who do what we do get sick of talking about it, but in 2020 with COVID, mm-hmm. that was just like difficult for all of us, right? It was difficult for everybody. Mm-hmm. But when you are in a, if we want to use it, it's kind of a crass way to put it, but if you're in an industry mm-hmm. that is designed around caring for people, and then suddenly you're faced with these unexpected limitations for how you can care for people. You know, at the time, my wife and I, we were leading a campus in our organization. We had 200 to 300 people, typically pre-pandemic, mm-hmm. attending on a weekend. And we were in a small town. There wasn't like a great internet infrastructure outside of the immediate city limits. How do we take care of all of these people that we feel responsible for mm-hmm. when suddenly you can't show up or, you know, you're not supposed to show up and gather
right.
on a Sunday morning? And I didn't have a great answer for that. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to take care of people, right? Mm-hmm. At the same time, I was also teaching at my alma mater.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was just a lot of conflict, and I was wearing myself out. And a friend of mine, who's one of our pastors, also a licensed therapist, was basically like, dude, you got compassion fatigue. Mm-hmm. Like, he put the dot on. I'd never heard of that. I didn't know that was a thing.
Yeah.
And he was like, I'll never forget his exact words to me were, he said, bro, pack yourself a bag and get yourself to an island. Mm-hmm. That's what he said. And I was like, they shut down all the airports.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, probably not a literal island, but and compassion fatigue is something that we as pastors, well, like you, we didn't even know that was such a thing, and it's more common amongst healthcare workers.
Right.
But when in the midst of that, there was that compassion fatigue, but there was also, and I don't know about you, but I said as a pastor, COVID caused my work to double or triple because I wasn't with these people every week. And one thing that I learned through COVID being a people person was that we have to have that personal connection, you know, that we need that.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
For a variety of reasons. Obviously, spiritually, you know, the mental health, you probably know the science behind a lot of that way better than I do when it comes to like all the neurochemicals that fire in your body when you're interacting with people in a way that, you know, that you enjoy and all those kinds of things. Yeah, we're designed to interact with humans. We're social creatures. Mm-hmm. Even
those that say they're not.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. Their problem is they've limited their social realm.
Yeah.
I was in a men's meeting last night, and we were talking about getting away and unplugging and that sort of thing. And one of the men said, you know, that's why I really like to go on cruises, because there's no cell phone service.
Mm.
And I said, well, cruises, I've been on several, but they make me very nervous.
Yeah.
And he said, why would you be nervous on a cruise? I said, well, let me put it this way to you. If you were on a cruise and you had no cell service, but you knew your two kids were back home and they couldn't get in touch with you if they needed something, would you not be anxious the entire cruise? And he said, well, absolutely. And I said, well, that's how a pastor feels.
Yeah.
You know, when we were disconnected, there was a Pew Research did a study not long ago and said that a pastor has to be on vacation for 14 consecutive days before they're able to unplug.
Right.
And I don't know many churches that are allowing a pastor to take 14 days leave, let alone, you know, another seven after that. Yeah. So,
well, I think one thing that I hear more than I used to hear is the word sabbatical. Mm-hmm. I know in our organization's gotten very intentional about sending people on sabbatical. Mm-hmm. And I think that's great. I love seeing that development.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's rough too, though. To unplug and take that time.
Sure.
You know, especially when you're the pastor and the only staff member.
Yeah.
You know, it makes it very difficult in those times. You recently got a new book here. It's called Be a Man the World Needs. Tell me a little bit about your book.
Yeah. Thanks for asking. It's sort of the culmination of a lot of things I've been thinking about for a long time. Ever since my early days in college ministry, I've always been drawn to investing in guys, men, young adults, and now older men, because I'm becoming older, right? And I just over time, what I realize is in the church, we talk about a lot of things that pertain to men, but we don't always seem to do the best job of equipping them to be the kind of man that our world out there actually needs. Like, And to maybe, I might be broad brushing or generalizing too much here, but I just, you know, a lot of the stuff, you go to a men's event or whatever, and they talk about like being a great dad, being a great husband, or managing these temptations you have in your life, or reading the Bible more or whatever. And I believe all that stuff is good, but that seems to be what we default to. Mm-hmm. And what I wanted to do is I wanted to get in there, and this actually wasn't going to be a book originally. It was going to be just a study resource that I would share with our men's ministry at our church. Mm-hmm. And then my co-leaders in my ministry basically said, please make this into a book. Mm-hmm. It's like, okay, I'll give it a shot. And so now what it is our format of study that we typically use is, we've done it with several books of the Bible over the past couple of years, is I will study the word and then create five devotions that we send out to the guys. We use an app to just communicate across all of our life groups in our church. And so they can get a deliverable right to their screen on their phone that says, hey, here's the reading for the day. And then, you know, I would throw them like three or four quick bullet points that are just some thoughts. But my favorite piece of it was at the end, they would come in the form of like a challenge question or something. Mm-hmm. So when I was developing those ideas for this book, I wanted to start at the foundation. Okay, why do men even exist? Well, because God created the world and he called it good, and then he created someone to oversee that world. So the implication there is that from the outset, from the very beginning in the garden, God established a world that was in need of men.
Yeah.
And I don't believe that design has changed.
Yeah.
So that's what the book is written to do, is to address and equip and encourage, hopefully. I try to be very encouraging, because guys get beat up all the time by Christian material. Mm-hmm. So, like, not a like a cheerleader, fire them up kind of encouragement, but a, like, hey, steady, go for it. this is who you are because this is who you were created to be.
Right. Yeah, and, you know, it's interesting even, too, if you look like Mother's Day at church. It's all mothers are great, they're wonderful, mm-hmm. you know, there's flowers, there's celebration. Yeah. But on Father's Day, it's typically a you need to be better at this, 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 and this.
Uh-huh.
And I've been to those conferences where they said, hey, you need to be a better husband. Well, what does that mean?
Right.
What does that even mean? You need to be a better dad. Well, what does that mean?
Yeah.
And I have found, at least within younger men, is that if they don't feel like there's a purpose in whatever they're doing.
Sure.
If it's just we're going because that's what we're supposed to do, it doesn't last very long.
Oh, no. No, the younger generations don't want to go through the motions for the sake of going through the motions. There has to be, which I actually applaud them for that, because we know, you and especially you as a mental health professional, you know, like, man, when someone discovers purpose and value and meaning, that's the thing that lights your fire for the rest of your life. Mm-hmm. So that's the goal of this book. Hey, guys, you have purpose. You have value. You have there's a meaning behind your very existence.
Yeah.
You connect to it. Dude, you're good to go.
Yeah. And you know, once you find that purpose, a lot of times, though, men are, well, I'm not good enough for that, or I'm not equipped to do that. And instead of going out and trying to find how to become equipped, it's, well, I just can't.
Yeah.
And so it's important for us as leaders to be able to see that potential as well and walk with them.
Yeah.
I think that's called discipleship. I think that's what that's called. But how, you know, just answering the question, how do you be a man? I mean, your book here is Be a Man the World Needs.
Yeah.
How do you be a man in a world that we can't even define what a man is?
Well, we can't. I don't know how appropriate it is to get into on this podcast, but I'm pretty sure I can define it.
Yeah.
A man is someone who lives out the design that God intended. Okay, well, then what does that mean? That means you look around at your world. We have this, let me jump back for a second. We have this, I think, fairy tale mentality sometimes when we look at like the beginning of Genesis, where like God drops Adam into this manicured rose garden with apple trees and all this stuff. And I just don't believe it was like that at all. I believe it was raw, untamed wilderness. And God was like, okay, now I need someone who's a steward over this, who has the capacity to turn this into something that can foster future generations, right? That can take care of it. So going back to that word, steward, like that's the kind of man, that's what a man is. That's the kind of person that this world needs, someone who will take care of God's creation, which the implication being take care of the people around him, help them, add value to his environment, to his relationships, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So, okay, so then there's further implications, right, which is what the book explores, is like that requires you to be a man. First of all, you got to believe that there's something worth pursuing. So this book is divided up into 12 like kind of maxims, like be a man statements. The first one, be a man the world needs, is what we just talked about. And then there's be a man of faith, because you have to have something to believe in that compels you to pursue that, okay? And then, okay, well, what's next? Well, be a man who's capable. Because if you believe in who you're supposed to be, but you're not capable of doing it, well, then there's another hurdle. And so I thought through a process of what are all of these things that could get in our way and inhibit us from being this man that this world, that our world needs, that our families and wives and sons and daughters and all neighbors, all these people need in their lives? What are the things that could be in the way of that? And how do we simply encourage men to walk towards the difficult boundaries that maybe are in the way and not see them as roadblocks, but as just hurdles on the path to getting where they're supposed to go?
Yeah. You know, I've never thought about the garden of Eden being imperfect and raw. But it makes sense when you look at the punishment of Adam was that he would now work by the sweat of his brow.
Yeah.
That at first it was enjoyable and it wasn't work as we would define work.
Right.
But it was enjoyable being in the presence of creation. And now everything is work.
Yeah.
so What do we do with men who, let's say, they haven't discovered their purpose, but they have a dream?
Yeah.
You know, that but their dreams to them seem so unattainable that they may not even want to share it because it sounds crazy. How would we approach that?
Well, I think
these are hard questions for you.
I love it. Some people's dreams are crazy.
Yeah.
But I can't remember the quote. But I remember listening to somebody talk about, like, if it's completely attainable on your own, you might not be dreaming big enough. Something to that nature. Like, you want to dream big. Mm-hmm. You want to go for it. And I'll tell you about my dream real quick. It's maybe an oversimplification. One of my mentors, Mark, he would walk into my office at the beginning of every year, Italian guy, like, Nate, what are you dreaming about this year? Mm-hmm. And I would look at him like, Mark, I want to be faithful. Mm-hmm. Because what I see all over the place around me are husbands who are stepping out on their families, mm-hmm. who aren't providing for their families, who aren't doing the things that I believe we're supposed to do as men, or who just give up. Mm-hmm. And for me, one of my dreams is to be a faithful steward of all of the opportunities that God has put in front of me. With Jamie and I, my wife, we tell people all the time, we've built a pretty great life out of saying yes to Jesus, because mm-hmm. we're just trying to be faithful to the things in front of us. So when a guy comes to me, I got this guy who's wanting to start this ministry that's sort of, well, it's unorthodox, I'll put it that way. It's really kind of outside the box, and he's in our institute, our school of ministry. I'm like, I think this sounds amazing. So let's resource you and let's mm-hmm. equip you and let's teach you how to start down this path. Mm-hmm. But one of the most important things about any dream is, have the big shining example down the road that you want to aim for, but figure out how to take incremental steps in that direction. And I can't remember the terminology, but that has to do with your identity. Like, mm-hmm. turn yourself, imagine the kind of person that you have to be to be someone who facilitates this dream that you have inside of you. And then, okay, well, how does a person that can do this, how do they live? What are their habits? All of that kind of stuff. And how do I begin to operate in that? Well, what's some small version of that?
Yeah.
You know, like, I'm a writer. I love to write these days. I remember when I first started writing my first book, which I threw away a long time ago and never, no one has ever seen it because it was so bad. I was like, you just got to do it. Mm-hmm. And so now I love to write. I have plans for lots of books that I, you know, God willing, I'll do before I breathe my last breath and step into eternity. But you have to do it a page at a time, mm-hmm. a paragraph at a time, a sentence at a time.
Yeah. I think probably one of the biggest challenges to men today is the expectation mm-hmm. of I have to have a job. I have to perform well at that job to supply for my family, but I'm so tired after I get home from my job that I'm not good at providing for my family,
sure.
not just financially, but being present.
Yeah.
And that every day is just a recycle of the previous day. Mm-hmm. How do we get to a point of where we understand that what we do is not our identity, who we are is our identity?
Yeah, that's good. And I think if you ever figure out the answer to that, mm-hmm. you'll never stop being invited to come and talk to. No, I think we have to try, though, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that's the long tension in that conversation is the conversation between being and doing. And then people talk about it a lot. And I don't know that any of us have it really figured out. I definitely would fall into the category of at the end of the workday, I'm tired, man. I'm physically tired.
Right.
You and I are knowledge workers. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, you've made so many thousand decisions and thought through all these things, and you're tired. That takes a toll on you. I think and this is how I try to handle it, is I try to set myself up for success in a way that puts some things in some boxes and puts some boundaries in place so that I can hopefully have the best of myself. Mm. You know, there's this conversation that aligns with what we're talking about, that we— that we hear a lot in our world, even outside of Christianity, of a work-life balance. Mm-hmm. And that's a complete and total myth. There's no such thing. You can't do that. When you're a person who's responsible for things, there are seasons of superior responsibility. Mm-hmm. You know, when my kid is sick, I cancel every meeting that I need to cancel because my kid takes priority.
Yeah.
But when there's a problem at work and I'm responsible for it, I may need to skip dinner with my family at night to go and handle that. Mm-hmm. That neither one of those are things I'm going to do every day.
Right, right. Yeah, and I think, you know, I could say I'm a pastor, but being a pastor is not my identity.
Right.
It's what I do.
Sure.
It's my purpose.
Yeah.
But it's not who I am.
Right.
You know, and you may or may not have ever encountered this, but if you take your kid to the park and there's other parents there and you get to talking, they're always going to ask you, so what do you do for a living?
Oh, yeah.
And the minute that you say you're a pastor, the conversation's completely over. You know, it's there's nothing past that.
Yeah.
And I think it's because of the years of the church throwing of you have to do this, you have to do this, mm-hmm. and the legalistic view of Christianity.
Sure.
And not the we get to do this,
yeah.
and we get to have this passion, and we get to have these dreams. But if Brian could do it in and of himself, then God wouldn't get the glory.
Right.
And if God's not getting the glory, then I don't need to be doing it.
Right.
And so where that identity crosses into the who I am is, you know, one of the big principles on a conference you and I have gone together at is that our identity is that we are beloved sons of God.
That's right.
And anything outside of that doesn't really matter.
Right.
You know, you may be a pastor, but your mental health is more important than you being a pastor.
Yeah.
You know, like you being a beloved son of God is more important than anything else in your life.
Yeah.
So just kind of wrapping up here, just your opinion. And I've asked a lot of pastors and therapists sitting in that seat this question, so there's probably no wrong answer.
Okay.
As a minister, somebody being in ministry, when you encounter a mental health condition of your own, mm-hmm. what do you do?
Well, I have friends. I have people that I can call on. Learned a long time ago that it is a disaster waiting to happen. You are a disaster waiting to happen if you are in pretty much any kind of leadership role and trying to isolate yourself. Mm-hmm. And I think it's doubly important for us in ministry because people depend on us and look to us as examples for how to live their lives. Now, you and I both know that's that's not always necessarily fair or right, but it is the way it is. And Paul, you know, 1 Corinthians 11:1, what did he say? Follow my example as I follow the example of Christ. So the example I try to set is I got close friends, I have mentors, I have people that I can say, hey, this is what's happening with me right now. There's some red flags. Help me figure it out. Mm-hmm. And there's been times, even in the last year, where I've had to do that because mm-hmm. I'm my dream is faithfulness, right? When I'm in my 90s, God willing, I hope they look back and say, man, he's got 70 years of this happening.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. Dennis Swanberg wrote a book called The Man Code. I don't know if you've ever read it.
I've heard of it. I haven't read it.
So The Man Code's pretty simple. The first number is one. We have to have a relationship with Jesus Christ. We have to have the one. And then you have the three, you know, Peter, James, John.
Mm-hmm.
We have to have the three people that we can confide in.
Yeah.
That will take it to the grave.
Yep.
That will not judge us.
Right.
That will love us, will pick us up and take us.
Yeah.
And then we have to have the 12, mm-hmm. you know, the 12 friends that we are communal with.
Yep.
You know, we carry each other's burdens, but not to a point of where we're confessing everything to them.
Right.
And then we have the 3,000, which is the church.
Yeah.
That every man needs a church. They have to have that community. Mm-hmm. And I would say that if at any point you're missing any of those items, you can't live to the fullest extent of what God intended for you to do.
Yeah.
You know, and sometimes we get people, well, I don't need the church. Well, you do. And you just don't realize how much you need the church.
For sure.
So putting a nice little bow on all of this, if you had one thing that you could tell the masses from your point of view as a Christian, what would it be?
that God loves you unconditionally and that he has a purpose and a plan for you that involves living for him, and that you can discover that by opening his word and doing what it says.
Yeah, that's great. Well, Nathan, it's good to have you with us here today on Doc Talks. How can people find you? How can they find your book?
Yeah, so it's you can go to my website, nathanking.com. Mm-hmm. Of course, I'm on all the typical social media stuff, and the book is on Amazon. All my books are on Amazon. So it's I'm cheap, so I don't pay for promoting them on Amazon. Yeah. So you have to type in the title of the book and my name usually, yeah. But that's okay.
All right. Well, it's good to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Doc Brian, you can find all of my content at thedocbrian.com. Again, you can find Christian content here at lifeword.org. You can find our podcast and all other kinds of content. And thank you for listening today. We appreciate it, and we will see you soon.